to Hotel Bar Sessions, the podcast where three philosophers sit down at the end of a long conference day to chop it up at the hotel bar, which, as we all know, is where the real philosophy happens.
Welcome to another episode of Hotel Bar Sessions. I'm Rick Lee, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts Jason Reed and Lee Johnson. And today we are talking about companion species. But before we do that, I'm noticing the two of you need some drinks, and I'd like to know if you're ranting or raving. Jason, let's start with you.
I'm going to have a Lone Pine Portland Ale, another one of our local breweries here, and I am raving about the novel Wrong Way by Joanne McNeil. It's a funny but also really smart novel about work and Silicon Valley ideas about how to transform society and the reality of working life for most of the people in this country. I don't want to give away any more of the plot because there's a big twist, but it's a lot of fun.
Lee, what about you? What are you drinking and are you ranting or raving?
I am just going to have a margarita today, and I'm raving about the Pixar film Inside Out. So I just recently rewatched this film and had forgotten how really good it is. It's a story about a girl, and her feelings are personified as characters in the film. It does have a pretty sketchy theory of memories, but I do highly recommend it as a film. It also made me realize that I think Pixar's whole business model is just to take things and make them into people. You know, like cars are people, toys are people, right. Feelings are people, bugs are people, robots are people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Because they can't do people.
Yeah, right.
Because the Uncanny Valley issue.
Right, that's probably true. Rick, what about you? What are you drinking and what are you ranting or raving about?
I am going to have a Crankshaft Kolsch by Metropolitan Brewery. They have closed, sadly, one of my favorite local breweries, but I found one in the back of my fridge. Ooh. So that's what I'm going to have. I am raving about the graduate students in our PhD program. We are in recruitment season for next year's class, and as part of recruiting incoming students, we have a colloquium where three of our current students give papers, and boy, the three of them gave really excellent papers that were really clear, well-argued, well-presented. I don't want to out them. I'll just give first names. So to Caroline, to Joe, and to Greg, congratulations. You did us proud.
That's DePaul University if you're a prospective graduate student.
Yeah, exactly. So, Jason, we're talking about companion species. What are you going to be barking about?
So, companion species, and I mean primarily dogs and cats, have been a part of human history for thousands of years. The first domesticated dog over 30,000 years ago, and the first cat not far behind at 10,000 years. So, in some sense, much of what we call human civilization has always been a multi-species endeavor. In recent years, however, cats and dogs seem to have taken on increased significance, both in terms of what they offer us and in our dedication to them. With respect to the former, the term emotional support animal has migrated from a specialized term to a general understanding of animals' roles in our lives. And with respect to the latter, many millennials and later generations have responded to the foreclosed possibility of having human offspring by focusing on their fur babies, to use the parlance of our times. We spend more on animals with doggy daycares and excursions and spend more time with them going to places like cat cafes. What does the significance of dogs and cats tell us about ourselves, the world we live in, and about our connection to animals?
I want to go to a cat cafe.
So, for the purpose of our discussion, I decided to break us down, starting with dogs, then cats, and then cats versus dogs. Although I realize there's going to be a lot of overlap, and I'm also not opposed to cats and dogs at the end as well. So,
what about hedgehogs?
What about hedgehogs? I'll play your silly game. What about?
No, I used to have hedgehogs.
Oh, really?
That's why I'm asking.
Personally, my philosophy on animals, I realize that as far as pets, I can understand having a pet that on one extreme doesn't even know it's in captivity. And that's where I would account like things like fish, maybe some reptiles where they don't even know they're in a cage. And then on the other extreme are animals that actually want to be around you. I have kind of an issue with the middle animals that maybe want to keep getting away from you. I'm not sure what hedgehogs do, but like animals that keep trying to get out, right. That seems to be a sign to me. Like maybe they're not an ideal pet.
Well, I know we want to get on to dogs, but let me just say the thing I liked about hedgehogs is they are spiky creatures. They have this ability to roll in a ball. And so if they don't want to have anything to do with you, they have a way to make that happen. And it works.
I think I might be a hedgehog.
Except instead of spikes, you have hatchets. So I feel like hedgehogs fit in a nice area that if they don't want to be around you, they have a way of preventing that from happening.
It's true. I mean, people have all kinds of stories about having connections with animals you don't usually think of as being pets. You know, people talk about some wild animals that end up living with humans for whatever reason, even stories of remarkably affectionate tortoises and alligators out there. So I don't know what to do with that. I will start with dogs.
Okay.
And I'm kind of interested in the spontaneous philosophy of dog ownership and the way in which people think about their relation to their dogs. Sometimes people anthropomorphize their dogs and treat them as if they're little furry children. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, people also do the other extreme where they caninize their own understanding of themselves. This idea that you're the pack leader, you have to become the alpha to your dog, and try to remake their own relationship to their dog on their own understanding of supposedly what wolf society would have been like. Both of those seem to be kind of a way to deal with the fundamental problem of the fact that dogs are in some sense very like us, seem to get along with us, but they also are very unlike us at the same time.
I don't know if you know anything about this, but I always worry that this alpha dog idea is the invention of Cesar Millan.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
I've never seen any studies that this is how dogs in the wild, and there are feral dogs in various places, whether that's how they operate and whether, in fact, there's one alpha dog who runs that pack and no other dogs are running that pack or have anything to, as it were, say in relation to how that pack operates. So I do worry that in a way it's a bizarre anthropomorphization of dog society as a quasi-fascist society.
Yeah, apparently the study, which was a study of not animals in the wild, but it was a study of wolves in captivity that created the alpha thing, has been thoroughly discredited in that what they observed was an adaptation to the bizarre situation of being in captivity, not some supposed natural thing. And there's a lot of criticism in the dog training world about that method, because often what someone like Cesar Millan gets from a dog is an obedience out of fear and freaking out, which is not the best way to train a dog. We should probably link to this. There was an article in the New York Times not too long ago that people in my family sent to me. It's always funny what people in my family send to me. But it was kind of like, has woke come to the world of dogs? Which is, okay, terrible. But it was pointing out that there's been a huge shift away from that and towards using things like positive reinforcement as a way of training. And also, most importantly, training as an idea of building not some sense of dominance, but building trust between animals. And human. If you want to call that woke, you know, I mean, the book has yet to be written on all the things that get to be called woke and how, at the end of the day, they end up being everything but being an utter and complete asshole with fascist tendencies. But that's for another show. I got more of a laugh than I thought.
It just caught me by surprise. Sorry.
Did you guys both grow up with dogs? I grew up with dogs.
I did. Yeah, a couple failed attempts to have dogs as I was a kid. And then eventually we had a dog. And we didn't think a lot about a lot of things people think about now, you know, in terms of training, in terms of what the dog did all day.
Right.
I mean, we were coming home from school. So dogs growing up were probably alone from the hours of 8:30 to 3:30, which is not terrible. But You know, we would never have considered the idea of a doggy daycare or anything like that. And as far as training went, you know, dog knew its name, could sit down. That was pretty much it.
Yeah. I grew up with dogs that were indoor dogs, that were family dogs. I mean, of course, they went outdoors. I mean, they ran around in the backyard and things like that. But my grandparents had basically like outside dogs. Mm-hmm. They were bird dogs or they were farm right. dogs or whatever, but they didn't ever come in the house. So this idea of training them wasn't a thing.
Right.
You know, I do think that the relationship between humans and their dogs as companion species has really changed a lot mm-hmm. in the last two generations, three generations.
Yeah. I mean, people who still use dogs in a working environment like sled dogs, hunting dogs, etc., will often stress that part of the reason they don't let them indoors is that apparently they do better if they're constantly habituated to being outside. So I think some of us, you know, pampered indoor pet people, it seems kind of cruel, but I think they would make the argument that at least their dogs work and get to do activity. That part of the problem with our indoor dogs is you have dogs that are bred to be very active, to do very specialized things, mm-hmm. and now we're telling them, forget about all that. Your new job is companion species. Your job is to cuddle and hang out on the couch.
To love right? me.
Yes. And for a lot of them, that's a hard thing to ask because they have thousands of years of being the fastest or the one with the most sensitive nose. And now you're telling them, forget all that.
Yeah.
Put on this vest.
Well, that relates to my story as a kid. When I was very young, my parents got a German short-haired pointer. And I think they got this dog as kind of an adolescent, maybe even a very young adult. Pointers are obviously working dogs and they want to be outside. They want to go along with hunters, you know, want to track down the thing you just shot out of the sky and show you where it is. And because of that, Clarence was his name. He did not enjoy, strangely, sitting in a living room. He would show his lack of enjoyment. So he went to live on the proverbial farm with a nice family. Then we didn't get another dog until years later. My mom, who doesn't really like animals, was in a park playing tennis. There was a cute little cockapoo, and the woman wanted to find a home for it, and my mom brought it home. And then when that dog died, we convinced her to get another dog that we got from a shelter, the Anti-Cruelty Society in Chicago. It looked like a German Shepherd, and it was a German Shepherd, but we convinced my mom it was going to be a medium-sized dog. And that dog ended up not working out, and we did find a good home for that dog eventually. So we had two dogs that we shouldn't have owned as a city-dwelling family with youngish children. And then we had one dog that worked out, and he actually got into a cabinet and ate something that was poisonous, and that was it for him. It was very sad. So my experience with dogs is that we had them from time to time growing up, but we had the wrong dogs for our situation for sure. Mm-hmm. And my parents were certainly not willing to treat the dogs like they were furry children.
Well, I grew up in a house where we always had dogs and cats, by the way, which I know we're not talking about cats right now, but we always had dogs and they were a part of the family. A lot of people love dogs because conventional wisdom is dogs have so much personality mm-hmm. as opposed to other pets. Again, I know we're not talking about cats right now. Cats do have personalities, like personalities other than bitch. But let's talk about dogs for a second. I do think that one of the things that's really interesting about owning dogs, I even hate to say owning, but that is the fact that we own dogs, is that they do help us socialize in a lot of ways that are similar to the way that other human beings help us socialize, that we build these relationships with them that help us understand ourselves and help us develop empathy, the ability to care. They assuage loneliness and all of those kinds of things. Except unlike other human beings, it does feel like that love and affection that you get from your dog is unconditional. I wonder how much we can translate what we learn about companionship from companion species like dogs to our human-to-human interactions.
I understand what you mean by the unconditional, but I also feel like my dog Bento, I think from his past, He gets very nervous whenever there's a display of anger around him. If I get angry at my printer, like stupid things, like not working, and if he's around, I try to tone it down a bit for his benefit because it stresses him out. You know, I don't know, but my theory is from his past, some of that anger ended up being visited upon him. So anger makes him nervous. I'm very aware of the contagious nature of my own affective comportment around him. I don't need to get angry at printers. You know, I don't need to, like, fucking stupid thing. You know, it doesn't help with other human beings, with other dogs. So there is a way in which they are unconditional, but they are affected by how we interact with them.
Yeah, definitely.
It's also interesting to me the behaviors in dogs that we interpret as love, and to think about what that might be like from the dog's side of things if it weren't love, if it were something else. I'm not denying that dogs enjoy being around us and maybe even do love us. And I know we're not talking about cats, but I have seen evidence that Lee's cat loves her and cares about her well-being, and it's uncanny the way that Champion takes care of Lee. But in a way, we've grown together, as you said, Jason, 30,000 years with dogs. We've civilized one another together. Right. There's obviously something dogs get from us and perhaps have come now to need from us, and there's certainly something that we get from dogs and have come to need from dogs. If we want to call that love, let's call it love. But I think that co-evolution that we have, or I don't know if evolution is the word, but at least co-socialization that we have is what, Lee, you were pointing to before, that we've become socialized with dogs around. They've become socialized with us around. We socialize with them. They socialize with us. And they socialize with us being social with other humans as we do with them socializing with other dogs. And so there's this really interesting meld, I think, with an animal species like dogs and the way we've come together for 30,000 years.
I like the way that you're phrasing that. And this really gets to my hesitation about saying that I own my dog, because I do think my relationship with my dog now, Dodger, is more of a partnership than an ownership. You know, the way that we talk about relationships with other humans in the social contract tradition anyway, is that we have this unwritten, not explicitly articulated contract with them that we're in a partnership to make a world and take care of each other. I do think that that's more of our, or at least my relationship with my dog. Now, Dodger is very unusual, I think, and I just want to say as an aside right here that we ought to be careful about talking about dogs as if all dogs are the same. I mean, dogs are very unique personalities. Dodger is very comfortable around strangers. I've never had a dog like this where if either of you came over to my house, I could say, could you take Dodger out for a walk? And he would walk right beside you and come back when you said come back. And, you know, just very unusual. I've never seen a dog like that. But that's just his personality. You know, he's just very easy around other human beings, but that is because he's been socialized around a lot of people and he has that understanding of, oh, this is what a partnership with humans means. It's not a blind loyalty to one human being, but it's something more complex. If we're going to talk about these species as companion species, it maybe is worth talking about something like a unwritten social contract that we have with them.
And Jason, I know you in the past have talked about Bento showing you things and teaching you things. When you're out on a walk, Bento wants to go over here, and then you learn something about your neighborhood that you didn't know before, and so on. And that seems much more like a partnership and an unwritten social contract than a object that is owned as private property by some capitalist rat bastard.
Yeah, like, for example, whenever I hold the chuck it, you know, the ball throwing stick, if I pull it out, Bento will sit and stare at me with this intense focus waiting for me to throw. And I've realized that I can use this like if we're walking along a beach and there's a dog fight breaking out down the beach or something I don't want him to get involved in, I just hold the chucket and he's like, boom, mesmerized, stuck staring at me. And one time some person walked by and they were like, oh my God, you have your dog so well trained. And I sort of didn't want to say, but I was like, yeah, I didn't come up with this. Like, I figured out how to adapt to this. I was like, oh, this is a thing he does. I'm going to use this to my advantage. So if I ever need to get him to just think about me and not notice the rest of the world, I just pull his thing out and he's like, boom. I figure out what sort of things he does. He sort of figures out what sort of things I do. We're both trying to make sense of it. You know, I think of us as two social large mammals sharing the same space together and trying to figure out what the other one wants is kind of the basis of our relationship.
Yeah, I definitely think about my dog as a person. You know, I know we use this word anthropomorphize, but as we've talked about many times before on this podcast, I think things that are not humans can be persons. So I definitely think about my dog as a person. I was just remembering that there's this passage from Jean-Paul Sartre where he says, in order to treat a man like a dog, you first have to recognize that he's a man. And I teach this in my classes all the time. And I say, you would never say, I treat my dog like a dog,
right?
You know, because it's a dog. But of course, that's not what he means by treating something like a dog, right? He means like treating it like it's not a person. My relationship with my dog is that I treat it like it's not a person. Mm. Not necessarily like it's a human, like he's a human, but like he's not a dog, you know, not an object, not something that I own.
Yeah. And we've broached this kind of thing from other directions on the podcast that once we get out of the habit of thinking that only humans can be persons or have personality, then I think one of the first things in the world that would qualify for having personality and therefore being something like a person would be an animal like a dog.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Alexa.
Canceled.
The animal shelter where I used to volunteer, you know, years ago, they did this kind of transformation of how they thought about both dogs and cats. Whereas before, they would mainly focus on assessing the adopter, basic things like do they have a past history of caring for a dog? Are they allowed to have a dog or cat where they live and so on? But years ago, they switched what they called, and I'm a little embarrassed about the term they use, caninality in dogs and felinality in cats. But basically, the idea was that rather than just think of a dog as a thing to adopt, they wanted to figure out, does this dog want to run around a lot?
Right.
Does this dog just want to sit on the couch with someone all day long? Same with cats. Does this cat want to play? Does this cat want to be with other cats? You know, and try to match people sort of like the way you match people on a dating site. Like, are you looking for someone to go running with, or are you looking for someone to sit on the couch and watch Netflix with you? And really was an attempt to recognize that dogs and cats are in their own ways, singular and unique in the same way that we are singular and unique. The best way to have a relationship is figure out how to relate to that.
Yeah.
I've been toying with getting a dog. My main hesitation is I'm often away for extended periods of time. And if I can't bring my dog with me, then I think it's cruel to the dog for me to be away for extended periods of time. Mm-hmm. But the shelter I'm looking at adopting from, they do precisely this kind of matching. And they have, I think, five characteristics, as it were. One is how active it is. Another is how well it gets along with dogs, how well it gets along with children. And they do really try to match you up. And I'm just trying to wonder, like, what's the dog that's good for Netflix and chill?
My dog's pretty good at Vanderpump and chill. So,
well, that's because your dog's smart.
Can we talk about the elephant in the room, which is it's so expensive now to have a dog? God forbid your dog gets sick. It's crazy expensive.
Yeah, it is. I thought that you were going to go somewhere else with that, and maybe we should come back around to talking about shelters, for example. But the moment that they start selling health insurance for dogs is the moment you realize that costs have gotten quite extreme. Mm-hmm. Do you all have insurance for your dogs?
Unfortunately, no, I don't.
I do. I mean, my understanding of it is pretty much catastrophic health insurance. You know, only kicks in at a high amount. Like, I've never had to use it yet. And I have been to the animal emergency room already once. The least fun place in the world.
Yeah. I hope this doesn't make me sound callous. So I'll say in advance that what I'm about to say about my dog also applies to myself and other humans that I know, but I don't think that I would be the person who, if I found out, for example, that my dog had cancer, would put it through long treatments and that sort of thing. I think that I probably would put him down. I mean, by the way, I would want myself to be put down, you know, if it was going to be financially devastating and just prolonged suffering. Mm-hmm. I also, while we're on the topic, do believe that our pets get better deaths than we do.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a combo answer to the insurance question. Well, not a combo answer, but also to point out that our pets do get better deaths than we do.
Although it's worth pointing out that veterinarians have one of the highest suicide rates among professions.
Really?
Yes. And the two things that veterinarians most hate to see are, one, someone needlessly prolonging the life of an animal because they don't want to part with it, but the animal is clearly suffering and has a decreased quality of life. And the other side is someone deciding to put an animal down too soon when it's just become an inconvenience. Mm. Those are the two things that veterinarians have to deal with. Plus, also, the other thing I think that drives the suicide rate is they have access to pretty quick and painless death that they know very well how to administer because it's administered by the pound.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we also probably should talk about how smart dogs are. I mean, this is the reason why so many dogs are service animals. It's not just because they're so well trained and attentive and actually sensitive to human needs, but because they're really, really smart. I know that there's also been a lot of programs, for example, in prisons using dogs. And it's one of the things that really frustrates me about how many dogs remain in shelters when we know how helpful they can be, how therapeutic they are for human beings. And it seems like you could put those dogs in retirement homes or prisons or elementary schools and give them a life.
Clearly, there is an expense, and sometimes a tremendous expense, that comes with having to care for a dog that someone has given up because they no longer want it, or their dog has given birth to puppies and they can't find homes for it. And so we have lots and lots of animals in shelters, and there's a lot of expense there. That's why for a long time, those shelters would euthanize the animals if they weren't adopted after a certain amount of time. But I also wonder, and this follows from what you were saying, Lee, we have a lot of weird ideas about where pets shouldn't be. Why aren't people bringing dogs to school? That just seems weird to me. Mm-hmm. If the dog is relatively well-behaved, and I would say the same thing about a student, then there's no reason why they shouldn't come to school or be in prisons or in all sorts of locations where we seem not to want them and we seem to forbid their presence.
Well, allergies. People are afraid of dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other reasons to not have dogs around.
But I wonder if people would be less afraid of dogs if they were in more and more places.
I mean, I think that that's probably true. But I, for example, kind of don't understand how people have reptiles as pets. Spiders, snakes, those sorts of things. They don't seem to have any personality. I'm sure that people who have these reptiles as pets would say that they do have personalities. But I also know that I'm afraid of them, and I don't know that being around them would make me less afraid of them. You know, I don't want to spend the time becoming less afraid of spiders or snakes. So, yeah, I mean, I get why they can't be everywhere, but they certainly can be more places than the shelter.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what would really suck right now? A commercial. Imagine the witty and entertaining philosophical banter being interrupted with an ad from MailChimp. Terrible. You can help us keep ad-free and free by supporting us with a donation. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions, where you can sign up to make a monthly donation at several different levels. Or, if you prefer a one-time donation, or to make sporadic gifts when you're able, just visit our website, hotelbarpodcast.com. You can find links to support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App. Now back to the interesting stuff.
I I'd like to speak on behalf of the cat people out there. I want to say that although I was raised with dogs, in my family, we always had a cat, but it was almost always an outdoor cat or, you know, an indoor-outdoor cat. So not really something that we spent a lot of time with or had the same connection that we had with dogs. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I got a cat as my one and only pet. And that was a lot for the reasons that Rick was mentioning earlier, which is that academic life is very irregular and it requires travel and all of those sorts of things. And it's just easier to have a cat. I mean, cats for the most part are very, very easy pets to have. They can take care of themselves. You can go out of town for the weekend and leave your cat at home and it's going to be fine. But I did not really understand how much personality cats had until I started owning a cat. Mm. And I now have two. I have Champion and Rascal, who I sometimes call Brain Damage because she's a little kooky in weird ways. But they are so different. They have so much personality. And one thing that I will say about cats is that they have a slight advantage over dogs, and that I do feel like cats are more emotionally attuned to their owners. I know dogs are too, but I just think that like cats have that extra sense. They know when you're sick, they know when you're sad, they know when you're anxious. And by the way, fun fact about cats, did you know that cats purring is at a particular frequency level that actually calms human beings, slows your heart rate down? When cats sit on you and purr and you feel calmer, that's actually true. You are being calmed.
And I can attest to that because Lee and I have been on Zoom conversations outside the podcast. We do talk outside the podcast. And when Lee is going through a particularly difficult time, and I only mention this because she has a cat and I don't, the cat who otherwise is not around is suddenly like rubbing on Lee and wants to be around Lee. And basically they're saying, it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. I'm here. And like right now we're talking and the cat is nowhere to be found.
Yeah, she's asleep in another room.
I guarantee that if Lee were upset, Champion would be right up next to the microphone.
Yeah.
That to me is an attentiveness that that cat has shown to your emotional state that I guess sometimes dogs have. I mean, I don't want to compare, but yeah, cats definitely do.
Second fun fact about cats, sorry, I'll be full of fun facts about cats, but second fun fact about cats is, do you know that cats don't meow to one another in the wild? That's something that they developed as a way of communicating with human beings.
Oh.
Although yeah. Dogs too have their own facial muscles that wolves do not have.
Oh, that's interesting.
They can move their eyes and make their eyes wide in ways that wolves cannot. They have muscles around their eyebrows that wolves do not have, which once again, they developed for communication with us to some extent, or have been adaptive for communication. I mean, I don't want to get into a fight about who's more emotional responsive, but I do think on the personality thing, one of the things I think is interesting is that, I mean, there are breeds of cats, Persian, Siamese, Maine Coon, etc., but most cats are kind of just cats, right? You know, like, I mean, there's not the breed between the species and the individual when it comes to cats. Whereas with dogs, the breed mediates between the species and the individual. And it mediates in the sense that it has actual qualities, but it sometimes also has its perceived qualities as well. That like people think a dog does something because it's a particular breed, but it might just be doing that because it's that dog.
Right.
And there's debate within the world of dogs, like how seriously should we take breeds? I mean, to the point where some cities have outlawed certain breeds or whatever. Sorry, I'm bringing this back to dogs. But my point being is that I think part of the reason the cats' personalities stand out so much is because we don't really talk about cats in terms of breeds. We talk about them as a general thing and a specific thing.
I don't know that much about the history of the human-cat relation, but my intuitive sense is, and I could be completely wrong, is that dog breeds – no, let me put it more actively. Dogs were bred – in order to fulfill certain roles.
Right.
And so dogs were bred to be shepherds, for example, and dogs were bred to be guards, and dogs were bred to be able to go into holes and get ferrets out and things like that. And I've never heard stories about the Persian cat was bred so as to, I don't know.
Knock a water glass off a table.
Yeah. I'm not sure what tasks cats would do besides hunting vermin.
Right.
And they all seem to do it equally well or equally poorly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know a story about this breed of cat was bred in order to do this task.
It's true.
I think that's right. I don't think that cats were bred for tasks. I think they were bred for appearance, to look differently than other cats. I do think that one of the things that's interesting about cats is that our interactions with them is obviously very different than that of dogs. Cats are aloof, mysterious. They seem intelligent, but it's a impenetrable kind of mind that's going on in there. Mm-hmm. I think this is why cats took over the internet. I think that's why lolcats is a thing, is because in addition to being very, very cute, they're also kind of above us in mm-hmm. a way that they're easy to use right. as a way to make fun mm-hmm. of human things.
Yeah, and I think their aloofness disturbs us. You know, okay, so maybe I'm talking more about my inner psychology, but their aloofness on the one hand disturbs us, but it also is attractive.
It totally is. Yes, it totally is. Yeah, they're not cloying. Mine are, you know, I mean, but when they're not, they're really not. And you can't make it do things.
Right.
It's very hard to train cats. I mean, I know people do train mm-hmm, cats, yeah. but it's very hard to train cats in the way that you train dogs. You know, do a trick for me, come here, sit down, give me a hug mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah.
And that is weirdly attractive, you know. So differently than dogs, I'd still think of them as persons, but persons that have more independence than I think of with dogs.
Mm. It's interesting that for cat people, the aloofness is a sign of a certain kind of intelligence. It's like smart enough to know not to get too much involved in our interhuman world. Whereas dog people would insist that they don't even know their names. How can that be intelligent?
Right.
Like in the dog versus cat person sort of debate, there are two different conceptions of intelligence. One is a kind of intelligence to be separate and be doing their own thing, however inscrutable it might be. And the other is intelligence to be responsive, to be aware and mm-hmm. to respond to things we do. And I will say that I didn't have a lot of experience with cats until I lived with them during grad school. And as a strong dog person, I was blown away by how intelligent they could be. But it still seemed very much on their own terms. Like I had once lived with a cat who would fetch,
mm-hmm.
but he would only fetch one very specific toy, just one little play mouse. And this was definitely not taught, you know, just the cat was like, I'm going to do this now. And then the cat right. would stop mm-hmm. doing that whenever it felt not like doing that anymore.
Yeah.
Although back to dogs once again, the classic question for me about dogs and fetch, there's an old cartoon where the dog and human are playing fetch and there's a thought bubble of both the dog and the human. And they're both saying, yeah, this is not that great of a game, but he loves it so much. It's a little hard to sometimes figure out like who's pleasing who sometimes with a dog.
Right. Yeah. I had a cat when I was living in Poland. We left it in Poland because a couple of times we traveled and my then wife's mother loved taking care of that cat and fell in love with it. And we told her we would get her another cat. And she said, I hate cats. And we said, but you love this cat. And she's like, yeah, but his name was Pitek. Pitek's not a cat. So we left him mostly for her. I trained that cat to do certain things, but in the way that, Jason, you were talking about training Bento to focus on you when you're holding, what is it called?
Chuck it.
The chuck it. I noticed the cat had certain behaviors, and when I wanted that cat to do that behavior, I would repeat the situation that I first noticed it happening. So I could get that cat to jump up on me if I put a glove on my hand. And that cat trained me. Maybe the thought bubble in front of that cat is he loves it when he puts the glove on that I jump on him. But the aloofness, I think, is sometimes overstated because I find, and Lee, you probably find this too, that Pitek would sometimes just like come and want to cuddle.
Yeah.
And yes, they do it on their own terms, but yeah, don't dogs do that too?
Yeah.
So I think that sometimes these characteristics are pushed to the extreme and we lose sight of the fact that there's probably a lot that these animals have in common.
Yeah, my younger cat, Rascal, I'm pretty sure wants to be a dog, like specifically wants to be Darger, my dog, and just follows him around and imitates things that he does. And although she doesn't fetch, like she absolutely loves when he's fetching, wants to be a part of the game. I do think that there are way more similarities than dissimilarities between how they are as companions, at least, you know, if we're talking about like domesticated animals. However, since we're talking about the aloofness of cats, I wonder whether or not that, I think Jason said, inscrutable nature of the cat mind is part of why we use them to replace the inscrutable nature of other human beings. Yeah. I want to go back to this, like, why do we use cats so much on the internet? Mm-hmm. How did cats become the thing that rules the internet? I think that's part of it. I think that, you know, we just have to guess at what's going on there. And so because we don't know, we can kind of put in anything, right, you know, as what they're thinking or what they're doing. I wish somebody would write the book on, like, why did cats come to rule the internet? I think that there's a lot to dig into there.
Yeah. In relation to that aloofness, cats have a certain kind of elegance as well.
Yeah.
They seem in many contexts to be more agile than dogs are. And that's why when they look goofy, like when we catch them in a picture doing something dumb, we appreciate it because in a way humanizes them. I mean, part of the way they took over the internet is, you know, like the hang in there meme where we caught the cat not looking its best in a wardrobe malfunction or, you know, they're falling down or something like that. But can I just say something that my cat P-Tech fell 11 stories.
No way.
And was fine.
Wow.
I don't think dogs can do that.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the cat as something caught off guard. The cat's looking awkward is part of what we post them on the internet for. When so much of what we do on the internet as humans is delete and curate our own self-presence so we never look awkward. So cats kind of end up being the stand-in for the awkwardness that we never want to see expressed with respect to us. So in some sense, cats are the internet.
I mean, they are also in the sense that there's always this worry, maybe insecurity, that the aloofness is actually disdain.
Yes, yes.
I think that there's a way in which we sort of allow them to express the disdain that we have as well.
But again, this goes back to individual psychology. We appreciate the disdain that they show for us because it reminds us of the disdain we have for ourselves.
Mm. Yeah.
The hotel bar, Rick, Jason, and I like to pour philosophy straight into your ears. We're an independent and ad-free podcast, and we'd like to keep it that way. But the only way we can do that is with listener support. You can help us defray some of our production costs by signing up to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. There are several levels of monthly donations there that you can sign up for, and every one of them helps us keep raising our glasses to deep conversations. If you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, or several one-time donations, just visit our website at hotelbarpodcast.com, where you can find links to support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App, and you can keep enjoying our tipsy philosophy and sobering insights.
So I feel like this has been brewing in our whole conversation, but we need to get to it. Cat versus dogs, or more importantly, I think, cat people versus dog people. Because I do feel like there are true cases where dogs and cats do not get along, as the stereotype suggests. But it's more to the point that the division is really between what people like about dogs versus what people like about cats. Often the positive thing that dog people like about dogs is turned into a negative thing for cat people. We were talking about this with aloofness, right? That dogs are loyal, but that loyalty to some cat people looks like servility.
Yeah.
It looks like they don't have enough of their own sense of a self and their own personality. Whereas to dog people, cat aloofness seems like just a fancy way of talking about the fact they're not that smart.
Yeah. I think also another difference is that dog people see cat people as servants to their cat, and cat people see dog people as masters to their dogs, that their dogs are servants to them.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because in both cases, it is the human in the partnership or companionship who always has to deal with the fecal waste, that always has to procure the food. And so in all cases, we are serving our companion in ways, frankly, that I don't know that I would serve another human that way.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Which does go back to the fur baby thing, right? You know, I don't have children. I don't want children, but I do want pets.
Right.
Yeah.
I know we've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I do love the suggestion that if we're going to call pets fur babies, that we should call babies skin pets.
You know, the stereotype is that us who do not have children but have animals in our lives, that they're just surrogate children. But I actually think it's the other way around. If you want something, it's always going to want to play with you, always going to be affectionate with you, and not going to develop enough of its own personality that it says, fuck it, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. Then you really want a dog or cat. You don't want a kid.
They don't come with a college fund.
Yeah. I mean, I never have to worry about my dog getting sick of playing with me. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or, you know, your dog going through that adolescence where everything you do is stupid and uncool.
Right.
And they want nothing to do with you. Until at 23, they want to move back in with you.
Right.
But on the other side of that, you know, most people don't outlive their children. And we're all going to outlive our pets.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to admit, for me, that is the toughest thing. The thing that made me decide to not do small animals anymore is the constant lingering death. I've put 4 hedgehogs down, all because of cancer. Ooh. And if that's happening every 3 years, you know, who needs that much death around?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. It's really hard.
It's devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, losing a pet is world crushing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more so for cats and dogs,
mm-hmm.
because the hedgehog is not in my world all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a dog is, and a cat could if it deigns to be.
If you're lucky.
If it didn't hate me so much.
Although the thing is that the loss is immense. And unlike other types of loss, where this relationship might not work out, might involve a breakup, or this friend might die before you do or whatever. I mean, unless something terrible happens, we know we're going to outlive our dogs and cats, or unless we're very old, in which case, mm-hmm. it's, you know. And what I think is interesting is that we go into that again and again.
Yeah.
I think it's against a certain trend, especially in philosophy, where philosophers tend to think that the only valuable things are the eternal, that ephemeral things by definition are not worthwhile. So you get either a theological version concerned about your eternal soul, or a more worldly version concerned about truth, because truth is eternal too. But I think that part of the embrace of animals in our lives is an embrace of the ephemeral, and the sense that, like, yeah, this is going to be incredibly painful when it ends, but while it's happening, it's going to more than make up for that. So you go in it knowing the pain is there, but knowing that there's something greater than the pain that's worth it, right? It's an embrace of the value of finitude, because finite things are not necessarily worthless because they're finite. They're worthwhile because of what they do for us while they last.
Yeah, and we can't not mention how much happiness pets bring. It's a truly pure form of happiness that companion animals give us. Even if short-lived, even if ephemeral, it is real, and it is something that makes our lives better.
I walk to campus often, and I could tell you every single dog that I saw on my way to campus yesterday, but I don't know that I'd be able to pick out any of the humans in a lineup.
Yeah, right.
And I say this because there are some dogs I look at, and just either because of the way they look or what they're doing, I just get a smile on my face, and it does just make me happy,
mm-hmm.
in ways that I never get simply by looking at a human being walking down the street.
I have some humans that I only know because of their dog.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's that guy that has the German Shepherd.
there's a neighbor across the street who has a dog. I've never seen it up close, but it looks like maybe it's, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of like a pug, you know, something like that. This dog I have never seen on its own feet. This dog
it's a handbag dog.
Is carried everywhere. Yeah. But the guy who I see, I was going to say walking it, he always holds it like a baby, which I think is funny.
Aww.
And that makes me smile in ways that if he had an actual human, I would not smile.
Yeah,
I know we were supposed to be comparing cat people to dog people, but I also think that there's a big difference between cat and dog people and all the other pets people, mm-hmm. you know, birds and reptiles and yeah. fish people. Mm-hmm. I've never had a bird or a reptile as a pet. I did have a fish one time, RIP Lieutenant Dan, but I never had a bird or a reptile, and I just don't understand them. Like, it just doesn't seem like the same relationship. So, mm-hmm. you know, listeners, I know that there are those of you out there that have birds and reptiles and fish and maybe other things as pets, and we definitely want to hear from you, but why do you think that is? Why do you think that dogs and cats have sort of risen to the top of the companion species?
Well, can I just say first, isn't it the case that everyone who has fish has them more as an accessory to their decor than they do in order to have pets?
I'm going to say no, just for my very short time having a fish. I will say that it was initially something that was pretty on the table, but no, they have, I don't know, personality, that seems like a stretch, but Lieutenant Dan definitely had a personality. Mm. Fish can recognize you.
I had a turtle for 20 years. Mm. I mean, I do sort of understand the charm of those pets, but it's a very different thing. It's like having your own little zoo of a sort, right? The turtle right. was all about having the setup with like water and rocks, and it was all very pretty, and the turtle would sort of hang out in there. It definitely wasn't very interactive at all, but it was fun to watch. And I know people who've said that they find fish tanks to be calming in their own sort of way.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. It's not relational in the same way that a dog or cat can be. It's more spectator to animal. People have claimed they've had more of a relationship with animals that are reptiles and so on, and seen personalities emerge. That's not been my experience, but some people do seem to think that there is such a thing.
But I wonder if that's because you're a dog and cat person.
Maybe.
That's the suggestion I was trying to make earlier, is it does seem like one thing that dog and cat people have similar is that they separate their relationship to animals from all other companion relationships to animals. Or, sorry, all other relationships to other companion animals.
Mm-hmm.
So birds might be different in what I'm about to say, but I think one difference is that animals that either have to or we make them live in a habitat means that we have to go and approach them if there's going to be any interaction mm-hmm. versus dogs and cats that by and large live in our houses with us and can come up to us when they feel like coming up to us or go away from us when they feel. That interaction seems much more mutual. Whereas even with my hedgehogs, there was only interaction when I said, okay, now we will interact. And the personality could never manifest itself in the hedgehog walking up to me and saying, hold me or rub my belly. And I think that makes a huge difference.
I agree with you. I had never really thought about that, but the habitat thing is a huge difference, right? You share a habitat with a dog or a cat, whereas yeah. a bird or a reptile or a fish has mm. its own habitat inside of your habitat, but yeah. you don't share it. You don't yeah. share a habitat.
I mean, I know some people let their birds roam free, but by and large, I think people put them in cages, and turtles are in aquaria, as are mm-hmm. fish. And so the personality is, if not one-sided, it's fleeting in the moments we choose to interact.
Mm.
You know, here, early modern philosophers who talk about our affects and emotions arising from a fundamental aversion and attraction, or maybe to put it bluntly, a fight or flight mechanism. We could also say a cuddle or run mechanism. That to the extent that our emotional life is maybe just what we mean by personality, or if not what we mean, it's a huge part of it. since some pets who have a habitat within our habitat can't manifest on their own coming near and running away, a whole part of their affective life is missing in our lives.
Yeah.
Speaking of companion animals, Hotel Bar Sessions is looking for a new companion co-host. Dogs and cats, well, can apply, but they have to be very articulate.
Rick and I are looking for a new podcast pet.
Yes.
We're putting Jason down.
I'm going to a farm out in the country.
He'll be so happy.
I can,
He'll be so happy.
I can run around in the fields.
But seriously, get in contact with us at hotelbarpodcast@gmail.com or send us a message through Twitter or Facebook if you think you might be interested in sitting down with us once a week and joining Hotel Bar Podcast as a co-host. We've mentioned already that Jason is leaving, and we're super sad about that. He's just leaving his bar seat. He's not leaving the podcast, but we do actually need a new co-host in his seat. So yeah, we're looking forward to hearing from you. I think that we should put pictures of our pets on the show notes for this. What do you guys think?
Sure.
I could put pictures of my hedgehogs.
So the bartenders told us not only are no dogs allowed in the bar, but it's time for us to go as well. And our companion species probably miss us at home. It's time for us to go back home and rejoin our non-human friends.
Aww. I thought Jason was going to say our real friends. Catch you later.
Bye.
Bye.